The following program, Early Settlements of Washington County, was originally presented over radio KOSC in Corvallis, March 5th, 1956, and was prepared by Ethel Johnson Moore and May Ringel Lepshat. It was compiled for the David Hill chapter, Daughters of the American Revolution, who sponsored it at that time, and due to so many requests for a local release, they again sponsor this broadcast over KUIK. Now, here's Mrs. Lepshat as narrator.
Thank you, Mr. Gillis. Washington County is part of the old Tualatin District, one of four districts to be defined by the Oregon Provisional Government in 1843. The territory in this district was a very large area, bounded on the south by the Yamhill River and on the east by a line through the center of the Multnomah or Willamette River, and continuing north to the Russian border and the Pacific Ocean on the west. Tualatin District received its name from the river called Tualatin by the Indians. The word means slow, sluggish, or meandering. However descriptive the name, the spelling had to be done phonetically, and since everyone had a different spelling, it led to a great deal of confusion, as one can see by the old records. Because of this, Joseph Meek petitioned the territorial government in 1849 to change the name of the county from Tualatin to Washington. At this time, the area in the county embraced the present Columbia, Washington, and part of Multnomah west of the Willamette. Many of the earliest settlements are now only crossroads, and all that is left are the records of those early pioneers. Some are the school records, others the road surveys, and still others the church history, which was given on this station earlier. Since our time is limited and our county is so rich in early Oregon history, we will limit ourselves to a few of the early communities and to the founders and the early growth of the two major cities in Washington County, namely Hillsborough and Forest Grove. The earliest records we can find about the early day settlers in Washington County are those of the mountain men, missionaries, and a few Hudson's Bay men. So much has been written about these men that all who have studied Oregon history will be familiar with them. For Old Tualatin District sent 13 men to Shampooig to partake in the historic meeting May the 6th, 1843. Late in the year of 1840, Joseph Meek and Robert Newell and their families came to the Tualatin Valley, where another ex-mountain man named Doty had built a cabin the year before. These men claimed land and built their cabins on the northeastern floor of the plains. According to early day narrators, they called the place Rocky Mountain Retreat. In 1841, other immigrants came to settle near them. They were Squire Eberts, Caleb Wilkins, and Joseph Gale, erstwhile trappers or mountain men, Charles Mackay and Thomas Ocean, who were Hudson Bay men, and Reverend John Smith Griffin, an independent congregational missionary, who had met Joseph Meek in St. Louis and had traveled west in 1839 with Meek and his party, and at Meek's invitation settled just south of the Meek claim. 1842 brought the first organized immigration of settlers to the district, and some of these settled near the mountain men, but many more of them claimed land in different parts of Tualatin District. The next year, 1843, brought many more settlers into the valley, and now the mountain refuge became better known as Tualatin Plains, now known in part as West Union. Tualatin Plains was the first sizable community in the Tualatin District, though it seems always to have been a community and never a town. By 1844, three separate church groups had been formed. School was held in the home of William Beagle, and William Geiger Jr. of West Tualatin Plains taught. After the territorial government was inaugurated, this school district became District Number 1 in Washington County. Joseph Gale had built a grist mill over on Gales Creek, and Richard Constable kept a store in his home, which is said to be the first frame building in the county. 1845 found Tualatin Plains a busy community, and the provisional government passed legislation to locate a road from Sobey's Island to Tualatin Plains, which would in turn connect with the Smythe Ferry on the Yamhill River. Charles Mackay, Robert Poe, and John Flett were appointed on the commission. The road meant that the Tualatin Plains settlers had a shorter road to the river ports. Before, they had to haul their grain across the valley and over the mountain to the Willamette below Oregon City. The year before, some promoters had cleared a road from Linton to Tualatin Plains. They believed that Linton would become the major city in the Oregon country. This road is the general location of the present-day Germantown Road. The first recorded road survey in Washington County was from St. Helens to the Dairy Creek Bridge. This survey followed the old road, which had been cleared from Sophie's Island in 1845. On September 19, 1852, a petition was presented to the county court to grant the newly surveyed route to become a road from St. Helens to the Dairy Creek Bridge, following the existing road and shortening distances where practicable. According to the petition, all claim owners were amenable except Ulysses Jackson. He objected because the survey went through a choice cultivated field. A compromise was reached and the survey went on. The names of the claimants living along the road, beginning with the town of St. Helens, which was then in Washington County, were Milton, Williams, Foster, Hoyt, Clanger's Mill, Lambertsons, all living on the Scappoose Plains. Then, over the mountain were the Jacksons, Mackays, Hoover, Ben Cornelius, Monroe, and Michael Warren to the Dairy Creek Bridge. This road was also used as a military road by the United States Army stationed at Vancouver. It was the most direct route to the fort in Yamhill County. While Tualatin Plains was growing in numbers and security, the population of the whole county had increased. The year's immigrants, which had helped to swell the numbers around the mountain refuge, had brought many settlers to the whole county. Communities formed in several other sections. One of these was formed a few miles south of Tualatin Plains, nearer the Tualatin River, and emerged from the immigrants of 1842. The new immigrants, Isaiah Kelsey, Ralph Wilcox, Richard Williams, Michael Moore, and David Hill, settled close together. Considerable confusion surrounds the early name of this community. Some records refer to David Hill as being in Tualatin Plains, and others say that he was from Tualatin. David Hill planned in January 1850 to locate a post office there, and he asked that the name of the place be called Columbia. He also asked that there be two mail deliveries a month from Oregon City and one from Portland. David Hill made application to be postmaster, and in a letter dated January 6, 1850, to Representative Samuel R. Thurston, he stated that the name of the county had been changed to Washington, and that the county seat, Columbia, was located on his claim. David Hill died in May of 1850, and Abraham Soger, who owned a store in the town, became the first postmaster of Hillsboro in August 1850. The townspeople had asked that the name of the town be changed from Columbia to Hillsboro to honor David Hill. David Hill had had a part in Oregon's early provincial government. He served two terms on the legislative committee, which acted instead of a governor, and he had been representative of the Tualatin District to the provisional government until a territorial government was established. So the new town's name was Hillsboro, spelled H-I-L-L-S-B-O-R-O-U-G-H, until the city was incorporated in October 1876, when the spelling was simplified to H-I-L-L-S-B-O-R-O, as it is today. David Hill had sold 40 acres to the town of Columbia, now Hillsboro, for a town site. And Isaiah Kelsey and his wife gave 12 acres to the commissioners for the site of the courthouse. The first courthouse was a double log cabin located on David Hill's land. Later, a cedar wood courthouse was built in 1852, and the first brick courthouse was built in 1872 on the square where the present courthouse stands. Hillsborough was the county seat of a very large area. Citizens of Portland had to make their way over the mountain and across the valley roads, which couldn't really be called anything more than trails. It was only 15 or 16 miles as the crow flies, but what a 16 miles. Hub mud, hub deep in the winter, and in the summer, choking dust just as deep. After a few years of travel over these roads, some energetic men from Portland formed a company called the Portland Valley Planked Road Company. They got a charter from the legislature and sold subscriptions for $100 a share to finance the project. The road officially opened in March 1851, is now our present-day Canyon Road. When we drive to Portland in 30 minutes, we find it very hard to realize that it sometimes took 2 days back in 1848. Many of those still living in Washington County will remember going to Portland over old corduroy roads. This road was a wonderful help to the Tualatin Valley folks. It meant a much easier way to haul their products to market, and the Port of Portland was beginning with the help of the Tualatin Valley. One of the first things to concern the pioneers in a new country was the education of their children. After the man got a roof over his family and enough food in sight to keep the edge of hunger away, schools for the youngsters was of prime importance. At least this was true of the Oregon pioneers. And so it was in 1851, the seventh school district in Washington County was established in Hillsborough by the Reverend Horace Lyman, Washington County's first county school superintendent. The first school building was a one-room log cabin at the corner of what is now 3rd and Baseline Streets. Later, a one-room frame building was built at the same location. Pictures of these two buildings may be found in the Washington County Historical Museum. In the early days, the school district did not always own the ground on which the school stood. So to remedy this, Samuel Williams, Henry Waring, and W.D. Hare in 1872 secured the title to two blocks from the city for $50. Later, a full city block was secured in a different location, and a six-room school was built. Some of the teachers of those early days were D.M. Seagalt, G.M. Hoopengarner, John Scott, Marion Adams, John Leland Henderson, Bill Barrett, and John Hawes. It is said that G.M. Hoopengarner and John Hawes were hired because they could keep order. The first county jail was built in Hillsborough in 1853 by William M. Brown. The logs were hand-hewn, 1 foot square, bound together at the corners by iron bolts or rods. The doors were made of boiler iron, and the whole building was approximately 12 by 14 feet on the inside. It was located between Baseline and Washington Streets near 4th. Ezra Stewart was the first jailer, and Richard Wiley was the sheriff. After a new jail was built, this little one and the property where it stood was sold to the Reverend James Cave, who, with a small family, lived in it for a time. Later, a house was built on the property, and the woodshed enclosed the jail. A few years ago, when the old house was razed, the old jail was uncovered. Only a few people were left who could remember its existence. The logs were given to the native sons and daughters of Washington County. In this group had it moved to the Washington County Fairgrounds, where it was restored as near as possible to the original. It can now be seen there. From the notes of the late John Brown, former historian for Washington County, we find that he says General Ulysses S. Grant slept there. General Grant was of lesser rank then, but he was in charge of Vancouver Barracks, then called Columbia. The year was 1854, and Grant had ordered supplies for the barracks from a San Francisco firm, and due to transportation and communication difficulties, he had not received a statement, and so the bill had not been paid. Richard Wiley, sheriff of Washington County, waited in Portland until Grant had come to Portland from Vancouver and then arrested him and brought him to Hillsborough for trial. Grant was acquitted, but he spent at least one night in jail until his friends could bail him out. In the earliest book of records from the county court, we find that on April 8, 1852, the county court ordered that 6 blank grocery licenses be issued to the sheriff to tender to those wishing to take such licenses at the rate of $200 per year for the term of 1 year, to be dated on this day and give bond according to law. Men who applied for grocery license on that day were Richard White and Colburn Barrel. It is impossible to say just where those stores were located. Another bit of business done by the county court that same day provided for a public library. The court ordered that each of the public officers of Washington County be allowed a statute, and the remainder kept by the county clerk as a public library to be loaned to the county inhabitants. The inhabitants had to give a receipt for the loan and could keep it 1 month. The officers of the court for that session were David Lennox, Judge, Alvin T. Smith, Associate Judge, and William Geiger, Jr. as clerk. In the early days of slow travel, it was impossible for many of the settlers to ride to the county seat, get their business done, and return home the same day. It was necessary to stay overnight, so about 1853, John Wood and his wife, Mary Ramsey Wood, built and ran the first hotel in Hillsborough. They called it the Washington Hotel. It is said that she was a very good cook, which must have helped their trade. During county court sessions, the officers of the court, the jurors, and others connected with the court boarded there. The hotel was located just across the road from the courthouse square on what is now First and Main Streets. Mrs. Wood attained a lot of publicity in the last years of her life, for she passed the century mark by more than 20 years. She died in 1908. Hillsborough grew slowly for the first 20 years, and much of the earliest history was recorded only in memory. There must have been a blacksmith shop or a livery stable, but we find no records of them until the 70s. Steamships plied the Tualatin in the early days. One named the Onward was a narrow stern wheeler which managed the crooked stream quite easily, but the other ship named Yam Hill was a side wheeler, and it had a lot of trouble negotiating the bends in the river. The ships navigated the Tualatin from Hillsborough to the Willamette River and hauled the wheat from the Tualatin Valley to Portland. They were discontinued with the advent of the railroad in 1872. In 1850, Peter Scholl applied for a license for a ferry on the Tualatin River 5 miles below the Harris Ferry for a fee of $200. The Harris Ferry at Bridgeport was run by Philip Harris and Felix Landis. There was another ferry south of Hillsborough run by Abraham Solger, who was Hillsborough's postmaster and also a grocer. The county court set prices for the fares, and the list of charges are interesting to us now, for we do not use money with the values they used then. Here are the prices. For each foot passenger, 25 cents. Each man and horse, 37.5 cents. Each wagon and yoke of oxen or span of horses and teamster, $1. Each additional yoke of oxen or span of horses, 25 cents. Each head of loose cattle or oxen, 12.5 cents. Each hog or sheep, 6.25 cents. 6 miles west of Hillsborough is another settlement, first known as West Tualatin Plains, later as West Tualatin, and now known as Forest Grove. One of the first, if not the first settler, was Alvin T. Smith, who came to Oregon with a wagon train in 1840. His land claim was just south of the present Forest Grove and was at that time called West Tualatin. By 1848, it boasted one store, also a post office, which was in Alvin Smith's log cabin with said Smith the postmaster. Smith, in 1844, feeling the need of a church in the community, sent a call to his friend Harvey Clark, who had been with the same wagon train in 1840 and had settled in Glencoe, to come to West Tualatin and aid in establishing a church. The two men erected a log cabin wherein church services were held on Sunday, and during the week Harvey Clark taught school to a group of children, the cost being $4 per month, tuition and board. In 1847, Clark was paid a visit by a little crippled widow woman past 60 years of age, namely Tabitha Brown, who had come to Oregon to be with her three children who had preceded her. She was interested in the education and welfare of orphan children and took over the teaching in the little log hut of Harvey Clark's. This part of Forest Grove's history has been written and rewritten many times. It is well known that this little one-room school was the beginning of Tualatin Academy and Pacific University, which received its charter in 1849, granted by the Oregon Territorial Legislature. Harvey Clark gave 200 acres to the new school, or, as it is recorded in the original deed, quote, blocks 1 to 34, unquote. At this early date, William Stokes had also granted land to the school. While speaking of Mr. Stokes, it is of interest to note William Stokes wrote his will the 19th of January, 1859, and it was probated the 5th of September, 1859. Children were mentioned, but not by name. Witnesses to the will were S. Hughes, T.B. Hoover, and Allison Hinman, all of Forest Grove. His widow, Laura Ann Stokes, gave bond as his ministrix, with Elkanah Walker and Cushing Eels as securities, Edwin and Myra Eels being witnesses. The marriage records show William Stokes and Laura A. Sealover were married by Harvey Clark the 20th of May, 1852, so their years of marriage bliss were short indeed. 1 year after William's death, on the 25th of September, 1860, Laura A. Stokes married as his second wife, Robert M. Porter, the marriage being performed by Elkanah Walker. Porter's first wife had been Carolyn Brown, to whom he had been married by Harvey Clark, the 19th of August, 1852. Forest Grove's early history is so closely woven in with the college that it was indirectly the cause of the town coming into being. We find that we must continuously refer again and again to Tualatin Academy and Pacific University, with mention of nearly every settler we may find time to mention within the limits of this program. The majority we will have to leave for some future date, and they should be included, for all were keenly interested in the little village and gave generously of their time, land, and money. Elkanah Walker and his wife, Mary Richardson Walker, with their children came to Forest Grove. In 1850, he gave 12.5 acres to the above-mentioned school, and the wing of the original Tualatin Academy, which is still in use and contains a museum, rested upon part of the ground he gave. To his own log cabin in 1851, he added a frame addition, the first of its kind to be erected in Forest Grove. At the Walker home one day in 1850, a group of women met and organized a maternal association. The purpose was to meet regularly for prayer and discussion pertaining to the responsibility and proper rearing of their children. Present were Mary R. Walker, Emmeline Clark, Mara F. Eels, Abigail R. Smith, and Sarah E. Burton. One of the early justices of the peace was Ira E. Purdon, a name prominent in the early days. He has many well-known descendants still residing in the county. He not only officiated at marriages, but often acted as a witness. Demand for jury duty. A family cemetery on the home farm is silent testimony of the early members of his family. Descendants still own and live on the old claim. We keep speaking of Forest Grove, but the settlement was not known by that name until 1851. A group of men, Harvey Clark among them, met and drew up plans for the new town site at Tualatin Academy. The academy, feeling the donors had been too generous in their gift, returned a goodly portion, which was laid out in ton lots the 10th of May, 1851, and the said lots to be sold to raise the necessary funds with which to operate the school. Can you imagine the great wealth? $30,000 would be in this period over 100 years ago. Such is the amount mentioned in the recording of the deed of Harvey Clark's gift of land to Tualatin Academy and Pacific University. Benjamin H. Catching and his wife, Lavinia, took up a 640-acre claim in 1850. A portion of this claim was deeded in 1860 to be used as a cemetery, to be known as the Union Cemetery, and to be under the direction of a group of trustees forever. This cemetery is located at the end of the road just beyond the Forest Grove water reservoirs and commands one of the most beautiful views in Oregon. Therein rest the pioneers and members of the families of Clark, Smith, Walker, Catching, Brown, Beale, Black, Barnes, Hinman, Macklin, Porter, Sewell, and many others who were residents in the 1840 to 1850 period. This cemetery reminds one of the early need of funds for the infant college. The trustees and a few interested citizens are working hard to incite enthusiasm amongst the descendants and residents of the county to create a fund to ensure the perpetual care for this, the final resting place of so many of the early founders of this community. Would that we had time to say more of this now second largest city in the county, which in 1853, besides the little post office mentioned before, had one merchandise store owned by Wesley Mulkey and George Fernside. S.T. Walker operated the first planing mill. In 1854, an agricultural society was formed in Forest Grove, and the first Washington County Fair was held in October of that year. Very few of the second generation are still living, and most of the old landmarks and buildings have disappeared. But memories of childhood are precious, and many of these places we remember, as well as hearing the names of some of these people named as friends coming from the lips of our grandparents and sometimes our parents, gives a feeling of closeness to those mentioned in this history. Therefore, it has been a great pleasure to have had a part in preparing this program. Thank you. Mrs. Patterson, while you are well known throughout the state, please tell us something of your parents, where you were born, and your early childhood.
May, I was born January 9, 1901 in Portland, Oregon, although my parents, Amos Cyril Benson and Georgia Rebecca Bosley, were residents of the state of Washington at that time. My mother, a native of Tillamook County, died 5 days later. My father, a native of Wisconsin, soon returned to Oregon and in 1902 married Ethel Chambers of Portland. Until that time, I lived with my mother's sister, Luella Sutton. Our home then became was moved to Clatskanie, Oregon, near the operations of the Benson Logging and Lumber Company in Oregon and in Washington. For a short time, we lived at Oak Point, Washington, where our home overlooked the Columbia River. In both places, we had many trips to the camps and the logging trains. On one such occasion, after my sister, Esther, and I had our hair cut short and were wearing overalls, a new cook asked my father if he had two sons, as well as the two daughters who had been with him recently. On another trip, it was made in a rented surrey with a return trip at night when we children were certain the wild animals would get us. Our Clatskanie home had a porch all the way around it where we loved to race our tricycles, which were the longer styles of that time. I recall that when my father had his mustache removed, Esther did not recognize him. In 1908, we moved to be near Portland. As my parents wanted acreage for a cow and a view of the river with ocean-going ships, they settled in St. John's, which was a separate city. The house is still there on a bluff a little west of the railroad bridge, and at that time above the dry docks. After renting a house the first winter, we lived in two house tents for the summer while our home was being built. We had a special play area enclosed by a circular driveway, and just inside the pavement was a border of Caroline Testo roses, which were so popular at that time. My father and my grandfather, Simon Benson, decided to have good roads as a hobby. Two projects besides the Columbia River Highway, which were closer to home, were the paving of Willamette Boulevard and establishing and paving the Greeley Cutoff. Before any through routes were paved out to St. John's, cars had to be jacked up for the winter by using stirrup jacks at the end of each axle.
Well, it is so interesting to hear these various incidents in your early life that only you could tell about. Now, may we hear something of your school days, the schools you attended, and so forth.
Before we moved to St. John's, my stepmother taught me to read, print, and do simple arithmetic. I recall doing the multiplication tables and reciting the alphabet backwards for my father. Formal schooling began at St. John's Central, where there were many memorable occasions. Civil War veterans came each year for a Memorial Day program. A favorite among them was a Negro veteran. When we heard he had died, we all cried. Calisthenics were spiced with weekly drills to music in the large central hall used for the assembly room also. When my class was old enough for Indian clubs, I was a leader because I had learned to swing them when I was much younger. We liked marching to and from our rooms to music at the opening and close of the day and at recess times. Fire drills were exciting and well organized. We were proud of our speed and order. But when the school burned many years later, it was at night. In 1915, I moved to Portland. I made my home with my father's sister, Carolyn Unander, but attended school for the eighth grade and high school at the College of Notre Dame in San Jose, California. I spent my Christmas vacations with my grandfather in Long Beach, California. In 1918, during the flu epidemic, we had a whole month for Christmas, and I did not even have a cold. Until Aunt Carolyn bought a home, we spent most of the summers in Hood River or at Seaside. But in 1921, I had a summer vacation in Europe. I registered at the University of Oregon in the fall of 1920. The large classes were a bit frightening after the small ones at boarding school. I majored in economics with average grades and a modest amount of dating. My activities were varied, culminating in the presidency of what is now the Associated Women Students. I graduated in 1924 with a Bachelor of Arts degree in spite of an appendectomy just a month before the close of school. That fall, I went to business college to learn typing and shorthand in preparation for the position as secretary to the Dean of Women at the university. She was Virginia Judy Easterly. I worked for the calendar years of 1925 and 1926. As the position was half-time at first, I worked on the university catalog half-time for 2 months. That period of fellow employee relationship with the faculty made it easier to know them on a basis other than that of student. Be that as it may, Pat and I never felt old just because we visited the campus. We loved to return for social events, football games, and committee assignments. I am now permanent secretary for my class, and I'm on alumni committees.
Wasn't it about this time that you met your husband?
Yes, it was, May. At the first student body meeting my freshman year, a young man jumped upon the stage to report for the then existing Greater Oregon Committee. Through the remaining college years, we saw each other, but we never became close friends. However, in 1925, I was advisor to the hostess committee at the university for the National Conference of Associated Women Students. The chairman had reserved two of the prominent men from those being assigned guests for the dance. I told her to take her choice, and I would ask the other. After that, Pat took the initiative for dating. 2 years later, on May 16, 1927, Paul Linton Patterson and I were married at the home of my aunt in Portland. Paul was deputy district attorney for Washington County. He lived in Hillsborough, where he rented a house just before the wedding, and we settled there after our honeymoon up the Mackenzie River. Hillsborough was Pat's legal home until his death, and except for 1 year at Cedar Hills, was mine until September 1959, when I moved to Portland. We have 3 children, 2 daughters and a son. Georgia Cyril, or Patsy, was born April 17, 1928. She lives in Ventura, California, where her husband, John Lane Smithson, teaches at the college. They have a daughter and 2 sons. Our son, Paul Jr., was born November 12, 1930, is now studying for a doctorate in mathematics at Stanford on a fellowship from Lockheed. He works part-time for Lockheed in their missile research department. He and his wife, Janet Hamron, have a son, Paul Linton, called Tad. Virginia Lee, Ginny or Jinx, was born October 16, 1932. Her husband, Fred Dollard, works in research department at Boeing in Seattle. They have 2 daughters and a son.
At this point, I would like to say Mr. Patterson did practice law in Hillsborough for 26 and a half years and served 2 terms as state senator before the time he became governor. Is that correct?
Yes. Paul was president of the Senate when he became governor December 17, 1952, when Douglas Bacay resigned to become Secretary of Interior under President Eisenhower. We moved to Salem January 5th when we sublet up an apartment at the Lee Apartments because the house we were to rent later was occupied by a legislator. In March, we moved into the house at 426 North Winter Street. It is located in the mall and is now used for a section of the Department of Education. We were living there when my husband died January 31st, 1956 in Portland. During the 3 years that we lived in Salem, there were numerous outstanding occasions. Without evaluating them, a few which come to mind were the campaign and election of 1954, the inaugural in 1955, the marriage of Ginny and Jim in July 17, 1955, and the inaugural of President Eisenhower in 1952, and his dedication of McNary Dam. The governor's conferences, and meeting old acquaintances and new ones in Salem at conferences and in their own communities. Then there was a 3 month bout with hepatitis in 1955.
Well, Mrs. Patterson, besides your domestic duties, what other activities have you had?
I'm not an inveterate joiner, but I do appreciate the benefits of group activity. Immediately after starting to work, I joined the American Association of University Women, and I'm still a member. In Hillsborough, I joined the American Legion Auxiliary, and I am a charter member of the Hillsborough Garden Club. Other organizations to which I belong are Gamma Phi Beta Sorority, Coffee Club, YWCA, for which I am treasurer and represent on the boards of the City and State USO, the Federation of Republican Women's Club, the Oregon Heart Association, and the Boys and Girls Aid Society. I am on the boards of the Easter Seal Society, the Rehabilitation Center, and the Theater Arts Association. I am a life member of the University of Oregon Alumni Association and the University of Oregon Mothers Club. I have been a member of the Oregon State and the Stanford Mothers Clubs. I belonged to the League of Women Voters before the war. However, the organization to which I gave the most hours was PTA at local, county, and state levels. I served 9 years on the State Board of Education, and I am now on the National Advisory Committee for the White House Conference on Aging, to be held in January 1961. I led campfire and 4-H groups, the latter for both boys and girls. Since leaving Salem, I resumed active participation in some of the above, and some of them were joined since then. I do take trips to see my children, relatives, and friends. My relaxing and creative hobbies are gardening, leather work, reading, listening music, bridge and just visiting with friends.
Well, thank you so much, Mrs. Patterson, for granting us this interview. Your main interests appear to be civic ones, dealing with people for people, which gives you and may give other participants a worthwhile purpose for living.
Okay. Please follow me, and you will enjoy a pleasant afternoon. From the thriving city of Beaverton, Washington County, Oregon, we turn south on State Highway 217, which meanders south and slightly east, brings us, after traveling about 10 miles, to the little town of Tualatin, which has a quiet, restful atmosphere. We turn a corner, and there ahead of us, a block or so across the railroad track, peeking through the trees, is the beautiful old Sweek House, which has the distinction of being 104 years old. The driveway is to the right of the house, and from there it comes to full view in all its early glory. The two-story white structure is most attractive, being of Western colonial architectural style. The beautiful large trees which shield it from the street include a locust, black walnut, and a huge chestnut, all planted soon after the house was built, and have grown to immense heights in the more than 100 years since. A porch the full width of the house is supported by five large pillars, is graced with an attractive latticed railing which matches the railing around the open balcony which skirts three sides of the building. The small paned windows, 12 panes in each window, mostly contain the original glass which was shipped from the east. Some of the old-timers think perhaps the lumber used in the building the house may have come from McLaughlin Mill at Oregon City, inasmuch as the house was built just 12 years after the McLaughlin House, and at which time Oregon City was the main trading post. At that time, Oregon City boasted of having the only post office in the Oregon Territory. In this day and age, some homes are built without a fireplace. Many are built with one. Sometimes a second is included in the present fad of the popular family room or patio barbecue on an outside patio. The Sweek House was built with four fireplaces, the main source of heat for the home. A fifth fireplace was later installed in the south end of the living room, which was originally the spot where a wood heater provided additional warmth, and the fireplace in the other end balanced the circulation of warm air. The dining room and two of the bedrooms upstairs have a fireplace, which were all part of the original building. What a dream the 34 by 27 foot living room would fulfill for present day entertaining, even as it did in the days gone by. Mrs. Sweek entertained each and every governor from the time the home was built up to and including Governor George E. Chamberlain, who was elected governor in 1902. The gleaming beauty of such a wide expanse of hardwood floor was most fitting for such entertainment. Opposite the front door, a wide stairway leads from the living room to the upper floor. In the corner of the living room, near the stairway, stands the old Chickering piano which came around the horn from Boston as a gift to one of the Sweek daughters for her 16th birthday. The present occupants will sorely miss it when it is called for by Dr. Harry and Mrs. Harding, who having been left to Dr. Harding along with the property by his mother, Lillian Sweek Harding, a daughter of the builder. Climbing the stairs to the second floor, one is faced with the smaller of the bedrooms, which has been furnished with furniture of the early period. The walls still have the original wallpaper. An about-face to walk along the hall, and on the left, the wall is enhanced by large framed pictures of the builder, John Sweek, and his wife, Mariah Beard. The pictures are on loan to the present owners of the home, and are destined by the owner, Dr. Harding, for the museum at Shampooig. The pictures show a kindness and hardiness which was proven by their success as pioneers. Down the hall and around a corner, where on the right we enter the master bedroom. It is furnished with an early bedroom suite of the pioneer period, which was found dismantled but reassembled. The suite includes a bed with high wooden headboards, commode, and chest. This is a large room in comparison with today's standards. It also displays the original wallpaper. I think we'll now go back downstairs and visit the dining room, so spacious and cheerful. These walls have the original wallpaper, a green background with pheasants or similar bird featured, room for a large number of guests to be seated comfortably and enjoy the burning embers of the fire in the fireplace. It has adequate windows on the east and north for plenty of daylight. Oh, how one heart throbs as we step into the large country kitchen. What was originally two spacious rooms has been remodeled and made one. In the days when our pioneer lived in this house, one room was where the help congregated to relax and eat their meals. The other was the big family kitchen, where over the good old-fashioned wood range, Mrs. Sweet prepared the luscious meals with her family around her. From each part, doors open onto the porches. A room we would describe today as a huge utility room was no doubt used for many things in the early days. A pioneer woman needed a place to set up her wash tubs. Pa needed a place to take off his wet clothes and his dirty boots. Maybe the kids played there on a cold, rainy days. Probably in the summertime, before the appearance of the bathroom, the wash tub was placed on the floor and filled with water for the necessary bathing. Two large pantries are also off the kitchen, providing storage at a time when a trip to the grocery store meant a whole day's travel. One pantry was built with double walls and insulated with sawdust or whatever was used in those days as storage for those supplies which needed to be protected against freezing. We must not forget to mention the back stairway going up from the east end of the kitchen. Upon reaching the upper level, we find two more rooms, which were both originally bedrooms. The larger of the two has now been converted to a modern bathroom. Downstairs again, let us go out the back door on the north side of the kitchen area. Nearby and a little west is a faithful old well that provided pure water for our pioneer family. The size of the housing would suggest that they had plenty of room to hang a couple of buckets for milk, or whatever they chose, to keep it nice and fresh as well as cool in the summertime. When John Sweet was a young man, he studied law and medicine and practiced both professions in his hometown before the urge to come west overcame him. He and his bride arrived at a place along the Tualatin River August 25, 1852, where they filed a donation land claim for 320 acres. The number of their claim was 4,258, located in Washington County, Oregon Territory, Township 2 South, Range 1 West, Sections 14 and 23. He first erected a log cabin on the place in which to live until the big house was completed. The luxurious home, which is still beautiful, is located in the northeast corner of Section 23. The date of the final settlement on their claim was February 20, 1853. John Sweet was the son of Martin Sweet, who was born in Virginia. His mother, whose name I have not learned, was said to have been born in England. The young couple traveled 3 months in a wagon drawn by oxen with a party of about 60 people, all westward bound to the Oregon Territory. It is said they called their claim Willowbrook. In applying for his donation land claim, John Sweet stated he was born in St. Genevieve County, Missouri in 1823, that he married Mariah in that same county February 29, 1852. Those signing affidavits for him were William Barr, Francis McKinney, G.C. Ryder, Levi Anderson, and Edward Byram. The coming of many people swelled the number of settlers, and a need developed for a place for meetings and recreation. The first floor of the Sweek home was completed by this time, and they graciously opened the unpartitioned upper room for community gatherings. People came from miles around for these festivities, many staying overnight, and enjoyed a hearty breakfast early the next morning in the Sweek kitchen before returning to their homes. One of Mr. Sweek's great desires was to create a city here, and on his property, he laid out the plat for the town of Tualatin. He had a part in cutting the first road from Boone's Ferry to Portland and Oregon City, which was their trading post and post office at that time. Most of the timber used in the breakwater at Oregon City was handled by him. He also hauled freight from the Dalles to Idaho City, where he was in the merchandising business for 6 years. History says of him, quote, "Whatever he undertook, he carried forward to a successful completion, for he was a man of indefatigable energy, strong resolution, and unflagging perseverance," unquote. It seems that one of the most important results of this strong character was the establishment of the Oregon school system. His 6 children were the first of the locality to receive a college education. His son Alexander, following his graduation from Pacific University, practiced law in Portland, and in 1900 was elected to the state senate on the Democratic ticket. Cyrus also practiced law in Portland, that is, with the Oregon Railroad and Navigation Company in Portland, and Lawrence removed to Grant County and went into business. His daughters, Alice, married M. W. Smith, and Lillian became Mrs. C. Harding. Mrs. Harding inherited the family home, and she in turn left it to her son, Dr. Harry Harding. About 1955, Dr. Harding sold the home to the present owners, Mr. and Mrs. Laurie Pratt, who are in the process of refurnishing the home with furniture of the period in which it was built. Dr. Harding and his wife, the former Lucy Weatherett, are now residents of Wilsonville. John Sweek died at age 68 years, 9 months, and enjoyed his home in the West for nearly 40 years. His widow operated the farm until her death. The lovely home stands as a monument to the memory of this outstanding pioneer couple. Hello, Mrs. Joseph Lefschatz speaking. Yes, I'm radio TV chairman for David Hill Chapter Doris American Revolution. Yes, our home designation is Hillsboro. Oh, yes, I've known Hillsboro a happy day celebration all my life. I will be happy to tell you something about it. Due to a question asked me recently concerning it, I did a little investigating to freshen and set straight my childhood memories. The glorious 4th of July, happy day. But why do we celebrate? So much could be said. But I'm going to quote from a timely article which appeared in the Hillsboro Argus on the date of June 23rd, 1898. Let us recall this date was right in the midst of the Spanish-American War. I quote, "Independence Day will soon be here. There is much in the idea of celebrating this day of all days. 122 years ago, our forefathers, with all their families comprising but 3 millions, made a declaration of independence. It was a parallel of modern Cuba against Spain. These old patriarchs of liberty successfully fought England, the greatest nation of the world, against fearful odds, and notwithstanding our enemy inaugurated a savage and Indian warfare against them, the revolution was successful. Let it be remembered that they were not afraid of going it alone, and if necessary, to die for liberty of their posterity. And so, when we, their posterity, are fighting that liberty may enter the souls of the people of Cuba, let all go to this annual demonstration with the full importance of the word liberty, and with a more complete comprehension of what our fathers have inaugurated." Unquote. The first Happy Day celebration in Hillsboro I have found proof of was held in 1895. The Argus, June 27th of that year, tell of a mass meeting held at the courthouse. The Honorable S.B. Houston, Mayor of Hillsboro, was placed in the chair, and he named J.C. Hare, W.H. Waring, E.J. Lyons, J.W. Morgan, and B.P. Cornelius on the executive committee to make complete arrangement for a rousing celebration on the 4th. Between 1895 and 1907, Hillsborough, Forest Grove, and Cornelius alternated in holding the celebration in their towns. And since 1907, Hillsborough has held a big celebration each year, with other towns in the county at times holding smaller gatherings. An important part of the celebration was the annual reunion encampment of the Veterans Association, which was usually held June 27th through July 3rd or 4th. And they were the veterans of the Mexican War, the Indian Wars, and the Rebellion. If the encampment ended on the 3rd, they held over for the 4th, so they might take part in the Independence Day celebration. It is natural my childhood memories of those earlier celebrations gave the old GAR veterans an important part, for my dear grandfather, George C. Thomas, was a very active member of that group. Businessmen's Club, Rotary, Chamber of Commerce, Business and Professional Women, the American Legion, National Guard, Boy Scouts, and patriotic organizations have all had a part in sponsoring the celebration. The city of Hillsborough appointed a committee with Orange Phelps, local theater owner, as manager and chairman, and sponsored the celebration for a few years. The Chamber of Commerce took another turn until 1935, when the Hillsborough Firemen formed the Firemen's Association, and that group took over the sponsorship of the Happy Days program, which they continued through 1959. Those firemen signing the incorporation papers of the association were Sidney Malhuish, who was fire chief at that time, and chairman of the new association. Also Andrew Lentz, Jay Phillips, Arlen Brock, Wilbur Dillon, and Paul Ringel, my brother, who is now deceased, as is Wilbur Dillon. The new sponsors as of the 1960 Happy Days is the Junior Chamber of Commerce. But what about the celebration itself? Oh, wonderful. And something for all ages. Although the celebration lasts 3 to 4 days, the day, down through the years, has started with a patriotic parade led by a man carrying Old Glory and a man representing Uncle Sam. For many years, the flag bearer was J.C. Lampkin, a well-known Hillsborough businessman. In 1897, James Lampkin awakened the citizens early that morning by a cannon, and when the parade formed, he carried Old Glory at the head of the line. The fire laddies were out in full uniform with the fire apparatus tastily decorated. The old soldiers marched in the parade, and they stepped to the music much better than the rising generation. Now, that group of old soldiers have all left us. And the old soldiers taking part in the parade of today are those from World War I. Three bands at that time, Hillsborough, Bethany, and Brevoort, took part. And a pioneer float in the parade with Willie Atkins dressed as an Indian chief and Florence Tongue as a chieftainess, with Reverend J.S. Griffin of 1839 and Grandma Woods, aged over 100 years, representing the pioneers of 1840, was a highlight of the parade. So on through the years, the stages of progress and patriotic advance are depicted in each annual parade. The parade disbands at Chute Park, and representatives of various patriotic organizations and distinguished guests are seated on the platform erected on the grounds. Chairs or benches are placed for those who wish to be the audience. The program starts with stirring music and the raising of the flag. More music, the invocation given by a minister, reading then of the Declaration of Independence. At the 1897 program, Miss Minnie Heidel, one of Hillsborough's young ladies, distinguished herself by giving from memory, in a rich, clear voice, the entire Declaration of Independence. A patriotic oration usually follows next, delivered by a chosen speaker. This portion of the day's activities inspires one with renewed love for this our country, which our forefathers fought and died for to give to us. From the very first, there has always been entertainment for all ages, and the carnival portion has greatly increased through the years. But within my memory, the merry-go-round has always been there, and the children of today love it as much as those of yore. The games of chance, the free shows on the midway, the ice cream and popcorn stands, and smell those hamburgers and hot dogs. Nowadays, even a real restaurant meal may be had. In the old days, it was a picnic basket packed by mother and a quilt spread on the ground and all sat around on the ground to eat. Many contests have been held through the years. In 1907, Willie Cornelius won the pony race with G. Smith and C.F. Wilson of Gales Creek in second and third place. The greased pig was caught by Ray Taylor, who then sold it for $4. The year 1908, the programs were shot to pieces by a heavy rain. The thrill of the old balloon ascensions held up, held apart until in the 1920s. In 1910, the ascension turned into a thriller when the ropes wouldn't work and the aeronaut, when he attempted to cut them, and he came down with the balloon in Mrs. M.A. Powell's garden, mowing a swath through wheat and potatoes. This celebration has always been considered homecoming for present and former members of residents of Hillsborough to renew old acquaintances. Baseball is always present, oftentimes a game each day of the celebration. Amateur teams more often than not. In 1907, the big game was between the married men of Laurel and the married men of Hillsborough. At the 1930 celebration, George Openlander of Forest Grove won the $50 first prize in the Bunyan Derby, which was a walking contest from the Journal Building in Portland to the Chute Park at Hillsborough. Included in contests were boys and girls races and a ladies' nail driving contest. I'm sure many remember the old dance pavilion, open air with benches built around the edge, a big canvas top, dancing all day and evening. The floor always crowded with swaying, gliding couples. After 1935, when the Farmers Association became sponsors, one-third of the proceeds went to the city. The Farmers Association kept one-third, with which they bought new equipment for the fire department. And the other third went to the Park Bureau and was used to improve the park. Today, the park boasts a big auditorium, well-built. By re-sanding and finishing the floor for each celebration, it could be used for dancing, until the trend of the times changed to roller skating, to which use the building is put the year around. Throughout the celebration, a continuous group of spectators enjoy the healthful dexterity of the skaters. Lots of play equipment is available for the youngsters, swings and slides and so forth. Enough picnic tables and stoves with wood stacked by to care for many picnic groups, large or small. Many groups hold their family reunions during the Happy Days celebration. The grand final climax, the fireworks. Boy, they were here in 1898 and perhaps before, and most likely every year since. May I again inject a personal thought? Between 1903 and 1908, my father, William Ringle, was one of a team who set off the fireworks. I used to worry for fear my daddy would get hurt working there where all that fire was, till my mother's comforting words eased my fears. Oh, that loud first bang, announcing to all that the fireworks are now starting, and the ohs and the ahs from the spectators. What a beautiful display, and every year they seem to get more spectacular. After the low peace which burns to a bright good night, the old folks and the farmers head for home, leaving the youth to dance or skate and enjoy the various carnival attractions. Many names and many events I have not mentioned, but time doesn't permit. But if you wish to enjoy a day of pleasure and one which stirs your blood with patriotism and appreciation of the liberty and freedom your country gives you, just visit Hillsborough Happy Days Independence Day celebration. It is a fitting commemoration to that liberty and freedom our forefathers fought and died for as a legacy to their posterity. Well, it's time to go now, and I'm so glad to have had this talk with you and tell you about an event which is close and dear to my heart. Goodbye now.